From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Project Help, dubbed the emotional 911 of Collier County, fields hundreds of calls each month from people in crisis, dealing with issues spanning from grief and loss to domestic violence and sexual assault. Victim advocates find the need for services doesn't take a day off around the holidays. We'll hear stories of recovery from local survivors of sexual assault and how they hope to use their experiences as a tool for helping others. Plus, hundreds of Floridians are expected to take part in the National Audubon Society's annual Christmas bird count. The holiday tradition unites bird enthusiasts throughout the Western Hemisphere in an effort to help guide bird conservation efforts and to add to the event's more than a century of data on bird populations. Find out what can make the event particularly fun and challenging for local volunteers. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, hundreds of people from across the state will soon be setting out to document the variety of species and numbers of birds in their area for the National Audubon Society's annual Christmas bird count. The cumulative data collected from across the Western Hemisphere helps identify the health of bird populations, helps identify trends, and helps guide conservation measures. This year's event, running from December 14th through January 5th, will be the 113th year, making it the longest-running citizen science survey in the world. Later in today's show, we'll explore how local residents can participate and some of the unique opportunities and challenges for Southwest Florida volunteers. But first, crisis intervention specialists find that the need for services doesn't take a day off around the holidays. Staff and volunteers at Project Help in Naples are inundated with hundreds of calls each month, from people needing help with anything from grieving after a sudden loss to surviving domestic violence or sexual assault. Project Help staff are the official victim advocates for the Naples and Marco Island Police Departments. The nonprofit provides a variety of services, including a 24-hour crisis hotline, counseling, a venue for support groups, preventive education, and even help with medical exams and legal issues. Joining me now is Project Help's Victim Service Coordinator, Eileen Wesley. Eileen, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks for having me, John.
And also with us this morning are two women on a similar road to recovery, but with very different stories of surviving sexual assault. Judy Castile is a Naples resident and a survivor of sexual assault as an adult. Judy, thanks so much for joining us today and for sharing your story.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here, and I'm happy to share my story.
And also with us is Jennifer Tutino. She's a survivor of sexual assault that ran throughout her childhood. She's in the process of writing a book about overcoming the experience on a spiritual level. Jennifer, thanks so much for being with us, and welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Oh, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
And I invite our listeners to join the conversation as well. If you have a question for our guests or perhaps your own story of survival to share, give us a call. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You may send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or post your comments on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And also as a warning, you may find this morning's discussion perhaps inappropriate if you have younger ears in the room or in the car with you. I just wanted to throw that out there. And Eileen, let's start with you. First of all, tell us just a bit more about the scope of services available at Project Help and the organization's role in the community.
Well, we try to play an important role in the lives of survivors of violent crime. What we are is first responders. We work with Naples Police Department and Marco Island, like you said, as their advocates for a response to any kind of violent crime that has happened. We work with Collier County Sheriff's Office on sexual assault cases. And in that case, we are first responders. We are advocates for the victim to make sure her rights are protected and that she has a safe place that she can talk and have the forensic exam and also possibly the police interview. So we give them that security, but the most first and foremost is we make sure that they're safe and that they know that we believe them and that they're not alone and that we're here to help. Mm-hmm. We offer a ongoing crisis intervention services, support groups. We will refer them out if there's something further needed other than our services.
Okay, so a pretty broad scope there.
Yes.
You know, in doing my own research for today's show, I came across a surprising lack of data when it comes to linking the need for these types of services with an uptick around the holidays. According to the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence, there really hasn't yet been a comprehensive study linking the holidays with those kinds of upticks. But anecdotally, do you and your staff tend to experience that?
Well, we get a lot of people who have been affected by sexual assault or domestic violence that are they need to reach out. And during holiday times is a hard time to reach out because everybody's very festive. They're very happy. They're very upbeat. And they're afraid they might not be heard or believed or just kind of pushed to the side. Our hotline is there 24 hours a day for people to hear. We do hear it on our hotline because people know that we're there and ready to listen. It's very hard to track the data that, that comes in during holiday times because a lot of times these people who are affected by violent crime are calling with suicidal ideation. So they're taken from a different perspective. They're not looked at as a violent crime survivor. They're looked at like somebody who's got depression issues, has had, you know, suicidal ideation because that's the road they're taking. They're sad. It's holiday time. They can't find that joy that everybody else is finding during the holiday season.
And you're looking to address, you know, the immediate crisis going on, which
exactly.
at that point would be the suicidal ideation.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. And Jennifer Tutino, I wanted to start first with you as far as, you know, getting these survivor stories out there. But first, how did you first become connected with Project Help? Because I know you're not initially or originally from this area.
No. You couldn't tell from this accent? I actually met Eileen because I became a speaker for RAIN, which is the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network. And when I was talking to the director over at RAIN, I had told her that I was anxious to get started because I felt that it was time now that my littlest had started kindergarten to really start speaking out against, you know, about what happened to me and being somewhat of an advocate for those who have suffered similar childhood experiences like myself. And she had put me in touch with the local crisis center, Project Help. And when I called Eileen, we spoke and initially and immediately just connected. So we had decided we would meet the following week. And I came into her office that Wednesday, and I've been volunteering every week ever since to try to really get a grasp on what they do so that I can kind of tandem with them and help them to know that if there are any child abuse children or women who have experienced this, that they need not be embarrassed or ashamed to speak about what happened because you can heal from this. And I never had a Project Help to help me. I had to figure out these steps on my own. But with a Project Help, you can really facilitate that healing on a much greater level and faster speed and takes a shorter amount of time for healing
sure.
when you have people who really support you, believe you, and can get you the help with the tools, you know, to heal.
Tell us just a bit about your story. It sounds like your abuse really went on almost throughout your entire childhood?
It did. My father was the person who had abused us for many years, starting from when I was 5 years old. And it was a continual kind of process. So that was not, for me, it almost felt like it was normal. And that was what was expected of a father. I had no other frame of reference. So when he would call me into the room or onto the couch, it was like, oh, this is what daddy does. And so, you know, it was everything that you can imagine that happens, that should happen between two adults, that happened between a father and a daughter. And so by the time I was 9 years old, my sister and I were actually giggling about what had happened because my sister had approached my mom one time before, and my mom basically went to our pediatrician, and the pediatrician said, no, kids can't, you know, they have vivid imaginations. There's no way that this could be possibly true. I know Mr. Peraza, and I know that he could possibly something like this. So she dismissed it, and I believe that when you hear what you want to hear, you can kind of take that and continue on. And so that's what happened. So it wasn't until several years later that we were on a bed and giggling about it, and my mom walked into the room and had said, you know, what did you just say? And we had told her, and, you know, after several moments of not wanting to tell her. And that's when she finally believed us and said, wow, like this is something I really need to address. And so from that point forward, that's when the divorce and the separation started. But she never pressed charges. So we were still able to see my father, which was not so great because although the sexual abuse stopped, there were drugs and alcohol that were introduced to us at a very young age. Mm. Cocaine, marijuana was it was the norm in our house. So we were on a contact high all the time in our house. So that wasn't so good. But at the same time, the sexual abuse had finally stopped by the time I was 9.
Well, and that was, but then it did also continue, though, when your mother remarried.
Correct. And then in between there, we had a babysitter who was found through a local church that was supposed to be a great couple with a good, you know, stable background. And they wound up, the husband and the wife wound up fondling. There was a lot of fondling and touching, and it was very, very, very difficult situation at their home. But yeah, I would say probably by the time I was 12, my mother found her second husband, and he slowly tried to buy my love and my attention. And I so desperately wanted that love from a father that I never had. So every time he would shower me with gifts, that was how he would lure me in. And eventually it started with the groping and the fondling and, you know, the makeout sessions. And again, it was like I was the wife. I wasn't the daughter. So that had went on in addition to a lot of mental abuse of there was a lot of control. So where it wasn't as physically deep as where my father relationship and I had, there was more emotional abuse, I feel, with this person because he knew what happened and he still took advantage of that situation and then tried to control me through it. You're walking the dog. You're not going out today. You're not going out after school. I'm 13, 14 years old. That's when you want to be social and to have that those social skill, you know, opportunities taken from you. And then also know that you have to be someone's, you know, you can't even escape that person at night. It was very, very difficult. And so that went on from when I was like 12 until I was finally, I want to say the sexual abuse stopped after I met my boyfriend. But then I finally came out to him when I was 18. And that's when everything was brought to the light and I moved out and wound up living with my uncle.
When on earth did this a period of healing, when could that even begin for you?
Well, that was the thing is, you know, for so long I had lived in this. I always had faith. And that was something that I don't know even how or where, but I always had faith. And I always knew that somehow, some way my life would get better. When I met my husband, I was 21. And I was 21, he was 23. We were both very, very young, but he was very supportive of me. And by the time I got married at 26, I felt like I had my midlife crisis. Mm-hmm. I broke down. I was emotionally, mentally, physically, I was shut down. And it was at that point that I knew this was my bottom and I had better get help or I'm going to go down a road that my father went down, which is drugs and alcohol. And I didn't want to do that because I was always the silent observer as a child. I always saw and took in and stepped back and said, that's not how I want to be. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's when I really started. I met a wonderful psychotherapist and I also read a lot of self-help books and spiritual books and you name it. I was like a sponge just sucking it all in to try to get better and heal. So I would say from the time I was 26 until I got pregnant with my first son at 30. And even after that, for several years, I was seeing my therapist just to get tweaks and, you know, because it was so intense for the first 5 years. It was like every week and then every other week and then every month and then bi-monthly for 5 years. And then once I had my son, then I would go back and we would have sessions, you know, repeatedly and so on throughout the course of the following 5 years. But it was a tough time. And I really feel like as an adult, you don't understand the scope of what happened to you as a child until you reach an adult.
Yeah.
And so that was the time when you know something's wrong, and that's when you need to kind of listen to that intuitive voice that has been shut down from these people, because that's what sexual abuse does as a child. It shuts down that intuitive voice inside of you that says you should do this or you shouldn't do this. Well, you're so confused because someone's been controlling you for so long that it's so hard to follow that gut. And yeah, so when you get that, finally, you get that gut feeling like, I really need to do this. You need to act on that intuition because that's the only thing that you have that will help you to heal.
And having your own children, I wonder if that maybe brought up some maybe anger that you hadn't realized was there. I mean, because as you're trying to do the best you can for your own kids, feeling like, gosh, my mom didn't really try to do the best for me.
It was really tough. I have to say that what's very interesting to me that I've been talking to other women who have been abused as a child is that they wind up becoming like best friends with their parents. Whether it's their father who's the abuser or their mother who is the person who allows the abuse to happen. And that's kind of what happened with my mom and I. We became best friends. We weren't mother-daughter. As a matter of fact, I felt like I was more the mother in a lot of situations than I was the daughter because I would tell her, Mom, what are you doing? You know, why are you drinking so much? We need this or we have to do that. And so there was a lot of this confusion in the hierarchy of parent versus child. Everything was completely out of whack. And so once I had my first child, I realized all of the things that I knew I needed to do as a parent and then the lack of that from my mom. It really cut deep. And so for a while, I have to say, from when my son turned about – it started when he was born. It started when I was pregnant. I was very angry with her, and I knew that there were issues that were stirring, and I went back to therapy. But it really – by the time my second child was born in 2003 – that's when I knew I had to pull away from my mom in order to heal so that we could come back to a healthy relationship. And we've had many a conversation and we really hashed out a lot of what our, you know, mother-daughter relationship was. And she apologized and she knows she could have done a better job. And I know that she holds a lot of guilt. But we have a real relationship now. Why? Because I healed. I learned to turn within and say, listen, God only gives those what you can't give what you don't have. So if she wasn't able at that time in her life to give me what she needed, I have to accept that. And I have to say, well, what can she give? And be accepting of what she can give. And that's how you can form relationships again. That's how you heal them and that's how you can continue. You have to accept what people can give you and forgive what they couldn't.
We're talking with Jennifer Tutino, and this morning she's sharing her story of survival, recovery, and hope following childhood sexual assault. We're also talking with sexual assault survivor Judy Castile and Project Help Victim Service Coordinator Eileen Wesley. Give us a call and join the conversation. Our number again is 877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Or post your comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And Judy, I wanted to get to your story now because I know it is very different from Jennifer's. But at the same time, there maybe you heard some similarities there, some identification. But just first, tell us a little bit about what happened.
My story, what happened to me was very odd. I believe even within the world of advocacy for sexual assault victims. I was in a local hospital in Naples, and I was in the intensive care unit, and there was a nurse. I was about to be transferred up to a regular room, and this nurse came in, pinned my head to the bed table thing that I was on, and proceeded to assault me sexually with a foreign object and with her fingers. I, unlike Jennifer, knew exactly what was going on, and I was crying and trying to crawl back up the bed table to get away from her. She had had the foresight to close the privacy curtain. So it was just she and I in that little cubicle. And I was crying and, you know, trying to get away from her. And she said to me, "Behave yourself, or I will tie down your hands and your arms." She had turned her identification card around. I could not see what her name was.
I was then taken up to a room, and this happened on a Tuesday. I was in the room. Everything was seeming to go just fine. Wednesday came. I stayed there Wednesday. Thursday, they came in and said to me, looks like your blood work is fine. If everything, you know, pans out, you'll be able to go home today. Well, I just took that as a sign of I'm going home today. I got up like I was in a hotel. I unhooked. I took the intravenous thing out of my arm. I took my heart monitor off. I got dressed and I walked to the desk on the floor and said, basically, I'm checking out now. And I just had to get away from that hospital.
Now, I know that you didn't, at first, you didn't say anything, and you weren't even going to say anything to your husband.
I was not.
What was that like, that period when you had lived through this, and then you're literally deciding, am I going to share this with the world, or do I just keep this inside forever?
I know. My background is a little different. For 20 years, I was married and lived in Philadelphia. I was married to a different man who was the district attorney of Philadelphia, who is now the chief justice of the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court. And I know when he was in the DA's office, even, how important it is to for victims to come forward. And I also know the statistics about how many victims do not come forward. And I was realizing firsthand of why I was thinking I wasn't going to come forward. But it was as if I got pushed into that. I knew I wasn't going to say anything. I did get discharged that Thursday. I did not say anything to my husband, and I kept trying to convince myself that if I just ignore it, it'll go away. The best way I can describe it, when something like that is happening and you know that it's happening, yet your conscious mind is trying to tell you, no, this really isn't happening. It's like seeing those people on Long Island. Along comes Hurricane Sandy. They're in floods. Everything is happening. And then the whole neighborhood burns down. You're looking at it and you're seeing it happen, but you just can't fathom that it's happening. So I went home and I decided that Friday night, I was home on Thursday, and I told my husband Friday night because I had made up my mind that I was going to press charges. And I also knew that I needed help. And I Googled rape centers, Naples, and Project Help popped up, and I made a phone call, and lucky for me, Eileen Wesley answered the phone.
She does that a lot, I hear.
Yes. And it was terrific. I could barely even speak to her. I think, squeaked out, I need help. Yeah. And come on in, you know, and she said, and I had this vision. I guess I watched far too many police TV shows or something. But I pictured that Project Help was going to look like the room in the police station, you know, and there'd be somebody sitting at a desk and I'd be in the chair having to tell my story. That is not at all what it is. It's a very home-like atmosphere, the offices, the privacy. It's a very welcoming place to go. Eileen, really, I was seeing Eileen 2 days a week for about a year. And then it went down to 1 day a week. And when I came to her, I was just a little balled up, thing of rubber bands. That's what I felt like. It was. It was all that. And because what happened to me happened in a place where I was supposed to be safe. It happened in a hospital. And it was perpetrated upon me by a person that was supposed to help me. It was the nurse.
And realizing just how bizarre that situation was, even within the realm of sexual assault, victimhood and survival, was there always this ever-present concern, whether it was your husband, whether it was Eileen or whoever, that they wouldn't believe you?
Oh, that was a huge thing. Well, I probably had some family members that did not believe me. But Eileen always believed me, and I was so lucky that the detective from the Special Victims Unit of the Major Case Department from the Collier County Sheriff's, Detective Zachary Ewart, was fabulous to me. He was so good. When I called the hospital, I tried to get the attention of the president of the hospital and the head of nursing. And instead, I was sent to visit the risk manager. Those are the people that make sure that they squash any kind of complaint and make sure that there is not going to be a lawsuit. That's really why I was sent to her. She did tell me that based on my case, they changed and they made a rule saying that two people had to be in with a patient at all times. But Detective Ewart had one meeting with her, tried to follow up with her, and she refused any further meetings. I mean, it was just a complete stonewall. But he believed me, and after 3 months of trying his best, even the nurse, she lawyered up. She refused to give Detective Ewart a statement. And I spent so much time going through it with this process of not being believed.
Right.
But I think...
And to date, I just want to say there hasn't been a conviction. It's
there has been nothing because there is no proof that this woman did this to me. And even I went through the whole thing with the prosecution department at the Florida State Department of Health. I can't even have any recourse whatsoever. I cannot on this station speak her name.
Right, right.
Now, the hospital would not give me her name. They would not give me her license number. I had to go through all that. I only found out her name because of the report. But there is that sense of wanting to be believed and that you know exactly what happened. And Eileen never questioned me. Detective Ewart never questioned me. When he came to tell me that they had to close the case, he said he came to my home to tell me specifically because he thought it was too important to tell me over the phone. And when I asked him why he spent so much time, why did you spend 3 months on this case, he said, because I believed you. And that's very important victims.
You mentioned that, too, in the very beginning, and it seems like it's a theme that kind of ran through both of your stories.
It's really important to know that sometimes a victim of any type of abuse, whether it's domestic or sexual, will only say the story once. So it's really important that they're believed on the onset, or they'll never speak it again. You don't want them to hold it in. Nobody would want to tell a story.
Right.
That, you know, it's so horrific what these two young ladies have gone through. And I'm glad I was there for part of Jennifer's journey and all of Judy's journey to be able to help her through it. But I do believe everybody that calls in to tell me that something happened to them, because I want to help them. Project Help wants to help.
And telling that story for the first time, I know had to be extremely difficult for both of you, but now you both are here on the radio telling your story. So what has changed? What has gotten you to this point?
My faith is my driving force behind my change. And that's, for me, that's the motivator, that I believe in something greater than I. And I believe that what we all have free will. And I believe that what one person does in their free will, God can use for something better. Mm-hmm. And that's really why I want to write this book, because I feel that if you just believe that you're a victim of something and you don't try to drive through it and use it to help you to heal so that hopefully you can be a beacon of light for others, then you're missing an opportunity, because that's the only way that I was able to get through this, is to know that, okay, this was something that somebody did something really bad, but I'm, you know, through my faith, going to use this to turn it into something really good and be a testimony for others to say, you can heal too. You know, you have to, you know, use your faith, but also use the tools and the resources that Project Help can give you to facilitate that healing, because then you can help other people heal. And I really believe that that's the main reason why we're put on this earth, is to help each other. And whatever gifts or whatever things happen, you know, we can turn into blessings, and we can make something horrible into something that will be used to help others heal. That's really the crux of why I feel I've changed, because now I know I've been through the hardest part of healing, and there's always going to be a scar, but it's not a gaping wound anymore. Now it's a scar, and every now and then it might flare up, but it's okay, because I know that this is going to help others to heal. And that's where I have the courage to be able to stand up for someone and say, listen, you don't have to go through this alone.
Yeah.
You don't. You can call Project Help. You can get help. There are so many things for you, you know, resources. But to keep it within is only damaging to you. And that's the message, is to be able to get it, to get the help that you need so that you can heal and get on with your life and pick up the pieces that someone else shattered. And take those pieces and turn them into your beautiful mosaic that, you know, will shine for, you know, to others and be a testimony for others.
Well, Jennifer and Judy, we are about running out of time. I could go with an hour just with each of you, I'm certain. But we are going to have to leave it there right now. Thank you so much for sharing your stories today on the radio. And Eileen Wesley, thank you so much for joining us as well. She is a victim service coordinator with Project Help. Advocacy, crisis response, counseling, and other services are available to call your county residents. The Crisis and Sexual Assault Hotline number is 239-262-7227. And comparable services are accessed through abuse counseling and treatment in Fort Myers, the Care Victim Service Center in Punta Gorda, and the Safe Place and Rape Crisis Center in Sarasota. We're taking a short break, but when we return, Southwest Florida bird enthusiasts are gearing up to join tens of thousands of volunteers throughout the Western Hemisphere for the upcoming annual National Audubon Society Christmas Bird Count. We'll have more on that just ahead. Stay with us.